Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So welcome people through space and time here to this presentation with Dr. Helen Wing. So what we're looking at today is, this is your brain on meditation using individualized brain signals to track. So neuroscience and research in developing a new measure of tracking when people are paying attention to their bodies during meditation, which Helen calls the embodied task. She will also be talking about clinical experiences teaching people about mindful body awareness to understand and process their emotions. Now, Helen is a neuroscientist and clinical psychologist. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. And she studies meditation from a neuroscientific perspective, interested in how meditation may foster emotion regulation to improve relational and physical health. So, Helen, I've been looking forward to this one. I put myself on there just to tune in. So thanks, and let's get it on the road.
Great, thank you so much. So I'm going to share my screen now, or my slides. Can you see them? Okay, great. All right, so meditation exercises are ancient Buddhist practices that are increasingly used to cultivate health. One of the statistics from the United States is 14% of adults now practice meditation. That's about 35 million people. And meditation practices have been adapted to treat mental and physical health conditions, including stress, depression, anxiety, pain, and symptoms of cancer. However, on average, we only see moderate improvements. So I do believe that in the media, the effect of meditation is a bit overblown. And this is because meditation is not a cure-all and different people respond in different ways. So you've probably noticed that some meditation practices really resonate with you while others don't. And this is what I found in my own personal practice and when teaching clients. So how do we understand these different processes and optimize meditation practices for each person? So as a scientist, my main measurement challenge is that I want to measure the internal changes cultivated by meditation and how this translates into external change. So the practices themselves tend to be quite internal with bodily sensations. There are many different qualities of attention, like being present-centered, being focused and non-judgmental. And then there are many different kinds of practices like sitting practice, movement practices, compassion, etc. And so we think by practicing meditation internally, it'll start to change our psychological processes, even when we're not meditating. So our attention to visual things, to our thoughts and feelings, even when we're not meditating. And then these will start to change our micro behaviors, our everyday behaviors that affect our psychological and physical health, such as self-awareness, eating, exercising, and social interactions. And then these micro behaviors over time contribute to our overall health outcomes, like our mental health and physical health. And that's why we think meditation can have this transfer effect all the way into helping symptoms of depression and anxiety, and also promote wellness, like engagement in life and relationship quality. So we need accurate measurement at every level to map out this process. We need both subjective measures, what people report, and also objective measures, so measures that are less influenced by what people think are going on, is going on. And I call meditation a black box because for the most part, when people close their eyes and start to meditate, we actually don't know what they're paying attention to. We don't know what's happening. And you've probably had the experience where some meditation sessions, you can pay attention more, or you notice different kinds of things, or you might be thinking different thoughts. And so every meditation is slightly different. And can we actually measure this process to understand how attention is being cultivated and how it might influence our health? So neuroplasticity is inherent into the philosophy of meditation. If we have the ability to change the way our minds work and how we act, then there should be neural changes that go along with it. And I majored in neuroscience in undergrad. It was a long time ago at this point, about 15 years ago, and so much has been discovered since then. Our brains are one of the most responsive organs to the environment, and it's constantly processing information for both the internal body and outside our bodies. Our brains and biology are not fixed. We're learning about things like epigenetics, how our genes are always being expressed in different ways depending on our environment. Adults are able to generate new neurons in the hippocampus, which is involved in memory. And before we thought, once you're an adult, your brain would no longer develop. And we're seeing brain changes due to motor training, such as juggling, musical training, cognitive training, and now as well with meditation training. All right. So I call this process measuring the immeasurable, because compassion is one of the immeasurables, and this is really difficult to measure, right? And so the promise of neuroscience is that it is more objective, and that we can actually read the mind using neural data. So instead of just averaging brains together and making interpretations of what the brain activity means, we can actually use machine learning to empirically understand what these brain patterns mean and then use it to understand what's happening during meditation. So I'll give you examples from my own work with compassion meditation and also breath-focused meditation, both of which are very important for embodiment. So mindfulness and meditation practices cultivate multifaceted parts of attention. It's not just one thing, right? There could be the object or focus of attention, meta-awareness, or being aware of your own mind, being present-centered, and emotional components like being non-judgmental and compassionate. And to see even more aspects of attention, you can read this review article by Antoine Lutz. And so when I talk about meditation to the general public, I try to break it down into two main components. One, meditation helps slow down our minds. We're often going on automatic pilot, going really quickly. Sometimes we need to slow down and observe what's happening, identify our experiences, which can cultivate self-knowledge. And breath and body-based meditations really help with this quality. Another main quality is to bring kindness to our attention, and this allows all experiences to exist. So oftentimes we try to push away negative experiences and then hold on to the good experiences. And this kind of dynamic actually creates a splittedness in our psyche and also a lot of symptoms. And so by bringing kindness to all of our experiences, it allows everything to exist and we can start to integrate these different parts of ourselves, which often leads to creative solutions. And this can happen within a person and also between two or more people and between groups. Loving kindness and compassion meditation really help cultivate these qualities. If we can start to bring these mental qualities to our everyday lives and not just when we're meditating, it creates mental space where we can begin to choose the better way of acting. And we can change negative cycles, and we can also cultivate healthy habits. And so some people learn meditation to try to exercise more, to eat better. I've worked with a lot of clients, and some of what we've done is change negative cycles in terms of relationships, learning new skills like stating clearly and calmly what you're thinking and feeling. And so it's been a big honor to be able to witness these changes. And so first I'll talk about my work with compassion meditation. I use what I call standard univariate analyses, or averaging brains together. But what I found based on my data and my personal and clinical experiences is that people's minds are quite different and unique. And so averaging all the brain activity together actually wiped out most of the effects. And so I learned an individualized approach to study breath-focused meditation. Okay, so compassion is the feeling that arises when witnessing another suffering and motivates a desire to help. And through the lens of a clinical psychologist, relationships are very important for health. Positive relationships foster stronger social ties and better health. On the other end, things like abuse and bullying contribute to depression, anxiety, and other health problems. And the quality of our relationships even affects our immune system, how quickly we recover from colds, and things like mortality, like how quickly we die. And it has the same level of effect as things like smoking and drinking. And so relationship quality and quantity are as important for public health as things like smoking and drinking. And I think people are not aware of that. Maybe people become more aware recently with the pandemic and social distancing, because a lot of people are having distress because of that. So with loving kindness meditation, you practice wishing well-being for others. And compassion is when loving kindness meets the suffering of others. So it's caring for and wishing relief from suffering. Scientifically, it's described as the feeling that arises in witnessing another suffering and motivates a desire to help. So we can make these parts more concrete scientifically. There's a situation of witnessing suffering. There's emotion and motivational responses to help, which we measure with brain activity. And it should increase the likelihood that someone engages in pro-social behavior to relieve suffering. So we can measure behavior as well. In compassion meditation, you first practice with a loved one. This could be a friend, a family member, or even a pet. And you actually envision a time they've suffered and practice mindful attention to the suffering so that you learn to hold that suffering with less reactivity. And then you practice wishing them relief from that suffering. You can use phrases such as, may you be free from suffering, may you have joy and ease. There's bodily awareness. So this is the bodily component. For me, I feel a lot of warmth in my chest area. So that's where I tend to place my attention. And there's also light visualization, where you can imagine a golden light growing from your heart to the other person's heart to help relieve suffering. So it uses a lot of senses. Then you can also practice compassion with yourself. And this is helpful because we can often have self-critical thoughts or be harsh with ourselves, and this can help with symptoms of anxiety and depression. You can also practice with a stranger, so someone you don't know very well, maybe someone you see on the street or a bus driver, as well as difficult people, so someone who annoys you or you feel rejected by. So think about how things in your life could shift if you practice compassion, even with people you don't really know or people that give you some trouble, right? So I like to use the metaphor that it's practicing compassion meditation is strengthening the compassion muscle, starting with the lower weight of a loved one and moving up to a higher weight of a difficult person. So then how does it impact the brain in helping others? At the Center for Healthy Minds, where I did my graduate work, they've studied compassion experts, and they see much more brain activity in the insula involved in body awareness and empathy in response to sounds of suffering. And these are meditators who've practiced for many tens of thousands of hours. And we use the magnetic resonance imaging scanner that uses magnetic energy to estimate levels of oxygen of blood in the brain. So that's our metric of brain activity. In grad school, my question was, what about people like you and me? Can compassion change our brains and how we treat others in a shorter period of time, just 2 weeks, 30 minutes a day? And over the internet, because people are busy. So the framework is that we think compassion meditation increases compassion, which should change brain activity and also lead to increases in real world pro-social behavior. So for me, it's not enough that we can feel compassion while practicing, sitting on a cushion or walking. I want to know that the compassion will actually impact how we treat other people in our lives and ourselves as well, because I really want to help people gain skills to cultivate a more pro-social and kind world. And so how do we study compassion training? We randomly assigned young adults to either compassion training, about 20 people, or to cognitive reappraisal training, where they learn to reinterpret the events in their life to feel less stressed. And they practiced 30 minutes a day on the internet for 2 weeks. We measured their brain activity both before and after the 2 weeks in the lab. And we also assessed pro-social behavior using an economic decision-making paradigm, which we adapted from behavioral economics, where they study social interactions using economic exchanges. And we developed this game called the redistribution game. So player A gets $10, player B gets $0, and player C, the participant, gets $5. In the first move of the game, player A shares $1 out of $10 with player B. And this is our model of an unfair interaction or suffering. Player C watches this interaction, and if they want to, for every dollar they spend, it takes away $2 from player A and redistributes it to player B. That's why it's called the redistribution game. And that's our model of altruistic redistribution, where you're spending your own personal funds to help a stranger. And we actually took that money out of their payment. So it was a real decision. We used an anonymous online interface. It was described in purely economic terms. People signed a separate consent form. They thought it was a totally separate study. So our first question was, does compassion training increase altruistic redistribution? What we found is after only 2 weeks of meditation training, the compassion group gave significantly more money in the game compared to the control group. So that's really good news. Just 30 minutes a day, that's 7 hours, was enough to start to change people's behavior. So in my opinion, I think everyone should learn or try compassion meditation for 2 weeks and see how it works for you, see what you notice in your life. Because imagine what this would look like if every person in the world practiced, right, and started to treat everyone more kindly. For the brain task, we showed them pictures of people suffering and also neutral pictures. The compassion group evoked a sense of compassion towards these people, and the reappraisal group reinterpreted the meaning of the pictures to feel less stressed. When I showed the study to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he called it effortful compassion. And his instinct was right. These were people who had never learned it before. You have to use effort to learn new skills. And as a neuroscientist, that often involves the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in thinking and planning. So the prefrontal cortex can be applied to emotions as well, not just things like math and reading, but also emotions, and influence the regions in our brain that process emotions. So I'm going to focus on the amygdala, which is involved in arousal and distress. It should decrease it, as you're learning to be more calm in the face of suffering, and also to impact the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in reward processing, so things you like and care about. To analyze the data, we created a different score between the post-training brain activity and the pre-training activity to see what specifically changed due to meditation, and we found what was different between groups. So what we found is changes in the parietal cortex, which is involved in empathy, and the prefrontal cortex involved in emotion regulation. And for both regions, the more the compassion group was able to increase their activity pre to post training, the more they ended up giving in the redistribution game. So, and this is not true for the control group. So the end takeaway is that people who changed their brains the most due to meditation ended up being the most giving. We also saw that the prefrontal cortex was communicating with the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in social reward. The more they communicated, the more people ended up giving in the altruism task. And this is really good news because they're encountering suffering, which is a negative, difficult stimulus, right? Yet they're able to recruit their nucleus accumbens, which is involved in reward, to evoke a more pro-social and caring response. So it's not just feeling bad when someone else feels bad, it's feeling caring when someone feels bad, and that activates positive emotion systems. We also asked, can compassion become embodied through changes in visual attention to suffering, so in the eyes, right? And so there's a whole body of research showing that where our eyes look tells us about our motivations and our interests. And so this is an example of a microbehavior where we practice looking at suffering internally in our mind's eye. Does it translate to looking at suffering externally at these pictures in the brain scanner? And what's really cool is that this study by Gannis in 2004 shows that visual imagery, so imagination inside and visual perception, seeing things outside, recruit largely the same overlapping brain regions. So you can see the two patterns are very, very similar. And this is really encouraging. So whatever we practice and visualize inside can help us start to shift how we perceive things outside. So this might be a neural mechanism for why visualization works. And so in the brain scanner, we measured where they were looking with eye tracking technology, which is very cool. And we could compute the percentage looking time at the negative parts of the images versus the neutral parts of the images, and associated this with brain activity. And what we saw is that the compassion group were able to look longer at suffering, right? They're learning to turn towards suffering. Yet at the same time, the brain activity in the amygdala was decreasing. So this area that usually processes negative arousal and can trigger the stress response is actually being dampened even while they can attend to suffering more. So this suggests that compassion can cultivate a more balanced emotional response in the face of suffering. So I think especially now when there's so much suffering going on in the world and we're hearing about it, a compassion practice can be very beneficial for our emotional well-being and to help cultivate good relationships. And it becomes embodied, right? If you can think of a time someone really listened to you when you're going through a tough time and what it felt like to be in their presence, if you felt really listened to, they were probably calm and really tuning into you and showing you looks of concern and like talking and asking you for more information. So being in the presence of someone with a compassionate eye behavior and brain behavior is like a very healing process. So this meditation is freely available to download from the Center for Healthy Minds website. You Google centerhealthyminds.org plus compassion training and you should find it. And last I checked, over 30,000 people around the world have downloaded this. And this makes me really happy thinking about all those people being kinder to themselves and other people. And I just want this to grow and grow, right? This should be part of everyone's education and wellness practices. All right, so we could change behavior in just 2 weeks. It doesn't take that much time. And then it also changes regions involved in empathy, understanding the suffering of others, emotion regulation, social reward, and decreasing distress. I also want to mention that empathy and compassion are distinct mental states and brain states. And this was done in a great study by Olga Klimeki and Tanya Singer, where people first learned empathy training and then they learned compassion training. So they practiced empathy training for 4 weeks, which is described as feeling with someone's pain, which then makes sense why it increases negative emotions and sharing pain. And it activates regions involved in processing negative emotions such as the insula and the medial prefrontal cortex. Whereas when they learned compassion for four weeks, they were practicing caring and concern for someone's pain. They're not just feeling the pain in and of itself. And that helped cultivate positive emotions in response to suffering and activated the reward system, the ventral striatum, nucleus accumbens, a very similar region that I found in my study. And so I think this is important for people to learn, especially healthcare workers, other people who encounter people suffering very often, that empathy is really important. We need empathy to understand that someone is going through a difficult time. However, if we stay in empathy, it could lead to burnout and negative emotions. And so we also need to learn compassion, which is meeting someone suffering with a sense of caring and concern. So now I'm going to switch to my research on focused attention to the breath and body. And this practice is really important because it cultivates what we call interoception, or awareness and understanding of our own internal bodily signals. And our bodily signals are always trying to help us, even if they're difficult or painful. I always try to think, my body is always trying to help me. It's talking to me. Can I listen to its signals? And it's trying to help us achieve homeostasis, or physical balance, emotional balance, and social balance. So one thing that you might not be aware of is, depending on who you're interacting with or who's in the room with you, your body's going to have different responses. And what's really cool is, because we're so attuned socially, and we're social animals, that our physiologies can actually become coupled with someone else. We can start to correlate with each other, especially if we're in good relationship with that person. And if it's a bad relationship, our physiology and stress responses are going to be activated. All right. So the body gives us signals about the state of our internal and external environment. So our brains interpret, you know, things we see in the environment. A cat may be happy if you like cats. It might be scary if you're allergic to cats. And so depending on how we interpret this, it can activate our sympathetic nervous system or parasympathetic nervous system, which impacts our pupil dilation, our heart rate, our digestive rate, our hormonal secretions. So emotions are fully embodied. There's no separation. Our bodies respond to emotional stimuli all the time. And some of those signals we can actually access through our conscious awareness, meditation, and yoga and other embodied practices. And so one thing as a psychologist is I really helped people become more aware of their emotions through their bodily signals. So in this study by Newman Ma, she asked participants to color in areas of their body associated with different emotions like anger, fear, disgust, happiness, and to color a brighter color if there's more activation, and to color a darker color if there's less activation. So you can see every single emotion has a different pattern of activation throughout the body, which can be recognized through machine learning. And this mirrors very well in my clinical experience when I helped people process their emotions. Sometimes we're just confused, right? Or we haven't had time to tune in and figure out what's going on. Like oftentimes we're just trying to get through the day and we don't always have time to reflect and ask ourselves, how is this impacting me right now? You know, as I'm talking to my boss or my kids or my partner, what's going on within me? And so sometimes we need time to just settle in and tune into the body sensations, and the signals start to reveal themselves, right? And so I helped my clients tune into their face. Our emotions are very expressive through our face. Sometimes we have to actually have a flat face, right? If we can't show how we're feeling. And so I think if you have to hide what you're feeling, the signals need to come out somehow. And so that's why this reflective time, therapy, mind-body exercises, they're so important to help us work through what may not have been processed earlier. Especially the heart area, the stomach, like in the slide I just showed, all of that gets sent throughout our bodies and we need time to sit with it and figure out what it means for each person. There's also physical sensations like hunger, thirst, and fatigue. I'm not going to talk about those sensations, but a lot of us like can't distinguish between when we're hungry and thirsty. They might feel like the same thing. But if we bring our awareness to the different sensations in our bodies, like our stomach and our throat, we can start to tease this apart and start to read all these beautiful signals that our bodies are trying to tell us. Okay, and this slide is just showing that mind wandering can be related to feeling less happy. They did this text message study, asked people, were you paying attention in this moment or were you mind wandering, and then had them rate their mood as well. And so it's generally showing if people were more focused, they tended to be more happy. And they're also more happy when they're doing social things, talking and conversation, making love is the happiest, yet they tend to do that the least, right? And so some people learn meditation to decrease mind wandering and increase focus, but I think we know there's much more to that as well. So we have this measurement issue in meditation where mental states are diverse and fluctuating, yet the standard neuroscience methods are to average them together. And I'm sure you've seen these pictures in the media. So if we're focusing on our breath, we may start on our breath and then our minds wander, thinking about dinner. Like I realize I need to have second dinner after my first dinner after this talk. And then you might return to the breath and then get sleepy and then think about public health as we're going through this crisis together. And so there are many mental states happening, right? We take a picture every 1 or 2 seconds with a brain scanner. Yet for most studies, you'll average all the activity within one person and then also average it together with 20 to 50 other people that they're not even related to, right? And we get these average group brains and we say, meditation increases the prefrontal cortex or something like that. And so that approach has been useful. We've learned many things. We get these beautiful brain maps. This meta-analysis averages the brain activity of all the averages from all the other studies, so 25 studies, and you start to see certain patterns with certain types of meditation. So for focused attention, we see more insula involved in body awareness, less posterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in the default network, that's with our narrative minds telling stories, greater activity in executive networks like the prefrontal cortex. However, I think these analyses are based on some false assumptions. So what we do is everyone has a unique brain structure and picture. This is a meditator and a matched control. And then we average it to fit a standard brain. This brain picture is made from 152 brains from Canada. And then we get a new brain picture that looks more like this standard picture. And then we average these brains together. But it's operating under the assumption that people's minds and brains work the same. However, if you've ever talked to other people, you realize, you know, we have unique minds. We process information differently. We have different values. And this doesn't have to be a problem scientifically. I'm learning to embrace the diversity rather than shy away from it. Meditation is also different over time. And this was really highlighted by Wendy Heisenkamp's study, where she had experienced meditators press a button when they were mind wandering and found that in that moment when they were mind wandering, their insula was activated because they became consciously aware of their mind wandering. Yet at different time points compared to the button press, like right before, that's when their default network was activated and they were mind wandering, and that they were focusing and refocusing at other time points. So we can already see there's different networks activated at different time points during meditation. So this is not just one mental state. All right, so now I'm using multivariate fMRI using machine learning, which conserves the spatial information. So everyone's brains can be their own unique environment. And then we preserve the temporal information so we can see these mental states fluctuating in and out. And this approach treats brain activity as unique, like fingerprints. And it uses the same pattern recognition technology that recognizes faces, that recognizes fingerprints. It can also be applied to our own brains to recognize our own unique brain prints. For fMRI, it's called multivoxel pattern analysis, or MVPA. So I might use that term. I'll try to just call it machine learning to be simple. All right, so evaluating multivariate maps of body awareness, that's what EMBODY stands for. Machine learning is well established in cognitive neuroscience. It can recognize different visual stimuli, long-term memory versus short-term memory, social pain versus physical pain. So now we're just applying it to internal attention states in meditation. For the first version of the EMBODY task, we're looking just at the object orientation or focus during breath-focused meditation. So it's just one piece of the meditation pie. There's so many different mental states we're not looking at. And so we apply pattern recognition to different brain activity representing interoception or body awareness or mind wandering. And then we can use these brain prints to actually read the mind during meditation. And I'll show you how we do that. So we have a 10-minute meditation scan, and most studies would begin here and end here, but we want to figure out what are they paying attention to moment by moment during that meditation. So what we need to add is 6 more data sets where the computer can learn what people are paying attention to. And we call this the internal attention task with step 1 classifier training or machine learning. So we start to collect data on what it looks like when people are focused on their breath, mind wandering, or self-referential processing. And once we establish this, we can then use that data to decode or estimate what brain states are happening during meditation. And we get this readout of mental states, which we can then quantify to estimate how long were you on your breath during that 10-minute meditation. And it still blows my mind that until this point, we could not answer that question. People would close their eyes. We have no idea where their attention is, and we can't estimate how much they were focused. And so this is what the EMBODY task is attempting to do. Our participants were 8 experienced meditators from the Bay Area in California, that they meditate for at least the past 5 years, 90 minutes a week, at least 14 days of silent retreat. And they mostly came from Vipassana and Zen traditions, where at least half of their practice involved attention to breath and body sensations. We did a very thorough interview to make sure that their practice was heavily represented by breath and body focus. We had 8 matched controls for age and gender. They didn't have any significant mind-body practice. And we included the controls because so many studies of meditation study controls that have no previous experience, and they learn for up to 8 weeks. And so I wanted to make sure that this task could apply to both groups of people. And for race and ethnicity, it was a mostly white sample. And so we had another study with more diverse meditators as well. All right, so what happens in step one? How do we actually train the computer to learn these brain patterns? The way we did this is we directed people where to place their attention. So if you ask people to focus on their breath for 10 minutes, they're probably not going to be able to do that for 10 minutes straight. But if you ask them to focus on their breath for 16 to 30 seconds, they're much more likely to be able to do that successfully. So by making the trials much shorter, we're collecting higher quality data of where their attention is placed. So they were told to pay attention to their breath. They were also told you may stop now, which should induce mind wandering. And so now we get data for a mind wandering signal. They were also told think about what happened last week, think about what's going to happen next week, so past and future, and think about what's happening right now during the experiment. And this is our model for self-referential processing, or that ongoing narrative that we tend to have going on in our minds. We also had 2 control conditions to pay attention to your feet. So this is a different part of the body, which would help make the brain pattern for breath more clear. And we said, pay attention to the sounds because the brain scanner is very, very loud with all that magnetic energy. And so now we can model being distracted by an external sound, which helps make the rest of our brain pictures more clear for the other conditions. So our first question is, can machine learning tell the difference between these 5 attentional states? And so in machine learning, you feed the computer a subset of data and it learns what the brain patterns look like. And then there's another set of data called the test data set. And based on what it learned, the computer then guesses what conditions are in the test data set. And we see if it's correct or not. And the metric we use for that is percentage accuracy. And so what we found is that for 5 different instructions or conditions, chance levels would be at 20%. The computer could recognize attention to breath, mind wandering, self-referential processing, attention to feet and sounds way above chance. So 40% or more, which is more than twice chance levels. So this means it can tell the difference between when people have their eyes closed and are focused on breath or not. And that's amazing, because their eyes are closed and it's black in terms of visual simulates totally dark. And we looked at each person and it worked for all 8 meditators who have a lot of practice focusing on the breath, and for most of the controls, 6 out of 8 people. So this is really good news, because we think this kind of brain task can be applied to both experts and people with no experience, which will just help the science a lot. So with this final N of 14, we did the rest of the study. This slide highlights that each person's brain activity was different, so we could identify the voxels that best contributed to accurate classification by the computer. Blue means less activation on average, and orange means more activation on average. And you can see for breath, mind wandering, and self-referential processing, the brain pattern is different for each person, for each mental state. And then for meditator 2, again, the brain pattern is different for each mental state, and it's quite different from meditator 1, right? Their signals don't look that similar. And then for the 2 control participants, same thing. The brain pattern for each mental state is different, and it's different from the other participants. So you can start to see, if you average all this brain activity together, you might not see very much come out different, because people's brains are representing these mental states in different ways. So the real power of this is, now that the computer knows these different mental states, it can we can apply it to the meditation period, the separate task where people focus on their breath for 10 minutes. It looks at every single brain picture and determines, does this look more like the breath signal, the mind wandering signal, or the self-referential processing signal? And it's based on each person's own unique brain data, not anyone else's data. And then it makes a decision at each time point about what they were focusing on. And so we get these individualized decoding or readouts of mental states during the meditation period. Here's meditator 1, they were on the breath and they start to mind wander. They think about themselves, you know, what's for dinner, or what am I going to do tomorrow? And then they return to the breath, they start to mind wander, they think about their lives, they return to the breath, right? And so now this data starts to look much more like what we know we experience when we're meditating. It's like going in and out of focus. And here's meditator two, based on their own unique brain signals, we can determine when they're on their breath or mind wandering. And you can see their rate of fluctuation is different than meditator one. So again, why would we average two different people together when everyone's having their own unique experience and they're meditating? Same for the control participants. They have their own rate of mental state fluctuation. And then we can start to quantify when they're on their breath, when they're mind wandering, when they're thinking about their lives. And we can count this and compute new metrics of attention during meditation. So we can compute the percentage time in each mental state, how many times were you on your breath, on average, how long were you on your breath, and standard deviation is the variability of how long you were on your breath. And so for each person, we can display these attention profiles. Each person has a different set of attention metrics because each person had a different experience during their meditation. So you can see for meditator two, they spent more time on their breath compared to mind wandering or self-referential processing. Whereas meditator three, it looks like they spent more time thinking about their lives and being focused on the breath. And then with enough data, we can start to look at this data at the average group level. But what we're looking at the average of is the attention, the metric of attention, not the brain. We don't need to average brains together because everyone has a unique brain. But we might want to look at, you know, how long were they on their breath? That might be useful. And so what we found for these 14 people is that on average, they were attending to the breath longer than mind wandering and longer than self-referential processing. And this is because when they were on their breath, the mean duration was longer. They were staying there longer, as if they were remembering to focus on their breath and actively trying to do so. And so overall, this pattern suggests that people are engaging more with the breath. However, we need to do more studies to ask people to tell us what they were focusing on and also compare this to a non-meditative state, because the attention profiles should look much different when they're not meditating, right? We would have much more mind wandering. And then this is just some more data to kind of see if we're on the right track. And so we also interviewed the meditators and got an estimate of how many hours have they practiced in their entire life. We did this through like a 30-minute interview. It was very extensive. We estimated in different time periods of their life how much they were practicing, if they went on retreat, if they did monastic practice. And so we got an estimate. And those that practiced longer in their life were the ones who could focus on their breath the longest in the brain scanner and thought about engage in self-referential processing the least. And interestingly, this was specific to the number of hours estimated on practicing the breath in particular. So the more they practiced breath focus in their meditation practice, the more they're able to focus on the breath in the brain scanner. So this is very encouraging. And this was not the case for the hours of estimating practice in other parts of the body. So this suggests that what you practice is what you're going to get better at. So if you consistently practice on the breath, you should be able to focus on your breath better eventually. If you practice with other body sensations, again, for my compassion practice, it's often around my heart area. I also pay attention to my stomach because my feelings of anxiety can be in the stomach area, as well as my intuition. So my creative energy is also in my stomach area. And so if I practice with those regions more, then I should become more skilled at that, right? So again, meditation is not a cure-all. If you just meditate on the breath, it's not going to start magically impacting everything else in your life. You have to direct conscious awareness to the areas of your life that you want to develop and practice, right? And I love using this individualized approach, one, because it makes more sense with the data itself. You could see that from before. It makes more sense with my clinical experience, where I learned to adapt meditation practices to different people for different situations in their lives. And it also honors diverse brain function. So a lot of MRI studies will exclude left-handers because their brains are shaped differently. We'll exclude people with mental health disorders, with neurological disorders. And this doesn't make sense. A lot of people come to meditation and mind-body practices because they're experiencing some kind of distress. Yet we exclude these people for many of the studies. So it can be more inclusive. I call this approach intersectional neuroscience, and where I took my own research process and tried to make it a more embodied, compassionate practice where I included more diverse meditators from underrepresented groups such as racial and ethnic minorities, LGBTQ people, people with disabilities, people with lower income. And I really just spent a year listening to them and hearing their feedback on our study. How do we make this more inclusive? How do we change our language? And we use what's called community engagement, which just means you involve the community at every step in the research process so their voice is represented. And we scanned 15 more experienced meditators. 80% were racial and ethnic minorities and 53% were LGBTQ people. You should check out the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland. Their website is here, eastbaymeditation.org. They have lots of classes and talks on Zoom now. And it's all by Donna. And it's a really wonderfully beautiful multicultural sangha. And I highly recommend learning more about their community. And what was really exciting is the individualized brain approach is working with all of these diverse meditators. We've essentially replicated our results. That paper is coming out soon. You can also find it at the Mind Archive website. And I was able to also show this work to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he was very, very interested in the multicultural community at the East Bay Meditation Center. And so you can find these papers, Focus on the Breath and Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. This is published and it's open access. Anyone can download it. At Mind Archive, we have the intersectional neuroscience paper. Anyone can download it, and hopefully that'll be published in the next few months. And again, just emphasizing the embodied study is the first to be able to read the mind during meditation. It still amazes me that we weren't able to really do this until now. And with more research, we will have unprecedented power in understanding how meditation improves health and well-being, and then uniquely tailor it to certain people and populations. We are still recruiting for experienced meditators in the Bay Area at embodystudy.org if that applies to you. And you can also email me at helen.wang@ucsf.edu if you want to support this research in other ways. Future directions. We have to adapt this to measure many kinds of practices, body scan, measuring meta-awareness and non-judgment, measuring compassion meditation, and with more data, we can map out the mechanisms of action. So what are we starting to shift in our meditation practice, in our internal attention, and how does that impact our external attention and our thoughts and our feelings and our social behaviors? And with this data, I hope we can use precision medicine approaches to tailor treatments to specific people and populations. And finally, I just want to say, encourage people to make meditation and mind-body practices your own. This is what I learned in my clinical work, that I felt more comfortable adapting meditation practices for my unique mind, I felt more comfortable adapting it for the clients in front of me. I am not wedded to focusing on the breath. There's so many other parts of the body, the stomach, the heart area has so much emotional information. So I always teach clients how to focus to those areas. There's so many qualities of attention. Start with what works for you. Practice with what comes naturally. So what do you naturally want to pay attention to? You can apply a meditative state to things like walking, nature, listening to music, drinking coffee, talking to friends, walking your dog, and bringing it into everyday life. And so that's how I personally made meditation much more ingrained in my day-to-day, is I really love music. And so I will listen to music mindfully, meaning I'm placing all of my attention on the music and letting go of thoughts and other things and just listening to the sounds and also being connected to how I feel in my body. So music is very tied to my emotions. And it's also for me like an emotional checking in process. That's what works for me. You should find out what works for you. And then to expand and grow, we can apply meditative mental states to growth areas or things we don't like as much, right? So some of the power of mindfulness is learning resilience, but you have to actually tune into things that are more uncomfortable to develop a resilient response to it. And with practice, it can start to change automatic pilot. So part of my personality, I do not like conflict at all. Yet by avoiding conflict, I created more problems in my life. So I use my mindfulness practice to directly address conflict, to have difficult conversations. And that is how I've, you know, advanced as far as a neuroscientist and being known in the mindfulness field, which I'm grateful for. So thank you to everyone. One more point, and then I'll stop talking for questions. I just want to say that in my clinical work, I'm working on this paper with Cynthia Price, and we're studying, we're quantifying embodiment or trying to describe a meditative state where more of your consciousness is filled with the bodily sensations and the mind wandering and self-referential processing is more quiet, and that we bring people into their bodies in this way to help them process emotions. So sometimes we're so listening to the story we say about our lives that we're not listening to the embodied emotional, physical truth of what's happening. And so in this data from the Embody study and an experienced meditator, we can actually see when this was happening for this person. We call it experiential space. This is when this meditator was in experiential space for the breath, where the body signals were much more in consciousness versus the other mental states. And we think this is very, very important clinically. We're writing this paper to hopefully show more clinicians like psychologists, body workers, nurses, like multidisciplinary clinicians, how to bring people into their bodies. It's not that complicated. I think people just don't know, aren't as aware that it exists and that you can do it in a relatively safe way, even as it might bring up some difficult experiences for people. Okay, so I'll end there. And thank you to all my mentors and collaborators at UCSF, the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, the Neuroscape Center, the East Bay Meditation Center, and my colleagues in Wisconsin, Texas, and Toronto. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. What I really appreciate about this work is that I guess there's two sides of it. There's the side where there's you're trying to show a research base to get people more interested in actually meditating and body-based practices, which can be useful. But then there's also, and particularly perhaps on this embodiment conference, there's these people who are really interested in these sorts of practices, but to have some sort of way of differentiating or telling which is more useful is something that's quite valuable as well. So I appreciate both sides of that research that you're offering. I've got a couple of questions here, and I think some of them may half be answered by your saying what works for you is what's going to work, but I'll give it a go anyway. For example, one of them was, what's more beneficial, duration or frequency of meditation? Is it better to do 10 minutes a day, 30 minutes twice a week? What works for people, or what do your studies show?
Mm-hmm. So one of my studies was 30 minutes a day for 2 weeks, right? For most of the studies on mindfulness-based stress reduction is like the bulk of the scientific literature. That's 8 weeks, 2.5 hours a week of class, 45 minutes of home practice a day. So the scientific literature is quite a hefty dose. So I always suggest people take a class first. I think like having the longer sits or body scans, you start to have a direct experience of being more in your body versus the thoughts. And so I think that's a great way to get a taste of what that feels like. And then on your own, you need to figure out what works for me to enter that space more frequently. So I would say do experiments with yourself. Like say this week, I'm going to do 10 minutes a day. And keep a journal or a log. You can rate like your mood before and after, or just write notes about how you're feeling after this 10 minutes and kind of reflect, how did this past week go with this 10 minutes a day? And maybe another week, do the twice a week, 30 minutes a day, and say, and also journal or rate your emotions or mental states. Like, how did that do? Because sometimes the longer sits help you achieve more calm, or sometimes our minds start to settle down, but the thoughts that do come up are important, right? So not all thoughts are like junk thoughts. Some of them, like mine, like especially the things that keep coming up that are nagging you, those are really important to listen to. Like when there's a relationship issue that isn't getting resolved, when there's a work issue, when there's something with your health, like, oh, I keep noticing even with my stretching and yoga, this part of my body still doesn't feel right. And so I do think having some longer practices, like half days are amazing. I know it's a lot to ask, but there's more and more online. If you can figure out a half day once every 6 months, like half days, I found are really helpful. But otherwise, like doing it with something you do every day anyway. So if you walk your dog every day, you know, spend that time in a mindful state. Or if you drink coffee every day, just tune into all the sensations of drinking your coffee and try to keep other things out.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any more time for questions. There's so much juicy stuff we could go into. Something I really appreciate with your work as well, as someone who's spent many months on meditation, silent meditation retreats as well, is that you're focusing on emphasizing that in sort of everyday life as well, because sometimes, particularly in those retreat environments, it's like meditate. Sometimes they incorporate walking meditation or eating meditation or something. Mm-hmm. Then it's really hard to suddenly go, all right, out into life, there's no integration. So do appreciate that you're noticing as well that having those practices does make a difference there. So that's really cool. Now I'm going to make a couple little announcements here. I've posted each of those links and the email that you put in the chat as well, but I'll also post your websites at the University of California, San Francisco there in case anyone wants to check it out and follow through on the papers and all that. Remember everyone that this will be up for 48 hours on the conference portal. So if you want to share it with friends or go back over it, follow up those articles, please do that. You can also get in contact with Helen, obviously. But if you do want to upgrade and get the package, what it essentially means is that if you're someone who wants to digest and have the entire library over time, all the meditation, breathwork stuff, because it's the best channel, or, you know, everything. So if you do want to do that, you can upgrade. It kind of helps us out because cost a lot of money to put this thing on. We're approaching break even, which is nice because it was $1 million. But yeah, if you would like to do that, it pretty much means it's free for the people that can't afford it and you get to own it in your own time. So that's kind of cool. If you do want to sort of, there's a lot of stuff here. So if you do want to have a chat to some people, you can go to the coffee break rooms, have a little chat there, talk with other humans, virtual humans. You might connect through space and time and practice your mindfulness doing so. And finally, there's also a Facebook group, and it might be nice at some point to actually start a thread on this sort of stuff. I know I have seen some threads in the Facebook group in the past linking research to various embodiment practices. And yeah, Gianni, there is actually a donation button getting added. It's not quite live yet, I don't think. There's also some stuff with people who are working with trauma survivors and those sorts of things. We're offering the recordings for free for those sorts of people. So yeah, do head across to each of those, have a chat, go to the Facebook group, check out what Helen's doing, get everything, up to you. And finally, to close, I'd like to give Helen the closing word of what's your top tip on how to be more embodied?
God. I think finding things you just naturally enjoy being in your body with. So I've recently discovered I love plants like a lot and it's a newer thing. And I like, yeah, naturally just want to look at them and touch them and like read their signals. And so finding things you already naturally enjoy, you're already in your body, you're already, your mind's a little more quiet, and just savor those times and build them into your routine.
Great. Nice one. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, everyone on Facebook. Thank you here in the room. Thank you, everyone who's watching it afterwards, which is most of you, actually. And have a great rest of your day, Helen, and we'll catch you later. There's the next talk actually coming up. I'll just say Sean Fargo is doing – he's a experienced – he's a Buddhist monk, or he was a Buddhist monk in the past, an experienced mindfulness teacher. So he'll be doing a session on that in 1 hour on the Meditation and Breathwork channel, how to teach meditation, how to teach mindfulness. So if you're in that area, please do check him out. All right, catch you, everyone. Thank you, Helen.